She dropped her kids off at school and vanished. Blood in the garage, lies on the cameras, and a smiling husband who swore he was innocent, until he took his own life before standing trial. But her voice didn't die with her. This is the story of Jennifer Dullows, told in her own words. A mother silenced, but never erased. Welcome to the Murder Tape Chronicles audiobook. If you haven't already, please consider following us on your favorite podcast platform. Today we present to you The CT Mom Who Vanished, My Truth. Let's dive into this thrilling narrative together. Chapter 1, A Life Divided. I used to think when your life falls apart, you'd hear it, like glass shattering or wood splintering under pressure. Some kind of sound to mark the before and after. But mine didn't fall apart all at once. It peeled away slowly, quietly, like wallpaper in a forgotten house. One corner at a time, curling from the edges until the truth underneath was too ugly to ignore. My name is Jennifer Farber Dullows. I was a mother before I was anything else. 5 beautiful children, each one a piece of my soul walking outside of my body. I used to write essays, edit manuscripts, and design my world around literature and love. I married a man I believed in, a man I thought would protect me, support me, love me through anything. His name was Fotis. When we met, he was magnetic, European charm wrapped in ambition, wearing confidence like a tailored suit. He built homes for the elite, mansions that seemed to stretch into the clouds, made of stone, glass, and ego. We lived well, too well. Private schools, ski trips in Vermont, cocktail parties with people who only smiled with their teeth. But love doesn't live in a 7-bedroom house. It lives in quiet moments, in how someone holds your gaze when you're speaking, in whether they reach for your hand or walk ahead without you. I didn't notice the signs at first. Or maybe I did, but I rationalized them away. It started with control. That's the word I kept returning to in my therapy journal. Control. He needed it the way most people need air. What we ate. How the furniture was arranged. Who I was allowed to call. How often I visited my parents. And then how I parented. How I dressed. When I smiled. The way he monitored our finances so closely, I sometimes had to ask permission to buy a birthday gift for one of our own children. Control dressed up as order, as efficiency, as love. But it was never love. Not the way I understand it now. After our third child was born, things started to crack. His temper, once cloaked in charm, began to lash out, private threats followed by public apologies. He'd explode over something small, missed appointments, a forgotten call, and then act as though I'd provoked it, as though my incompetence was to blame. He called me forgetful, scattered, overly sensitive. And I believed him. That's what emotional abuse does. It takes the most confident parts of you and erodes them, until you question your own memories, your instincts, even your own fucking name. By 2017, I was unraveling. The divorce wasn't just an ending, it was a war zone. Fotis didn't just want separation. He wanted domination. Full custody. To win. Because to him, everything was a game with one goal. Control the board. No matter who got sacrificed along the way. I knew leaving him would make things worse. I just didn't know how much worse. That year, I moved into a home in New Canaan with the kids. I rented it under my own name. Quiet, simple, nothing like the glass and granite fortress we'd left behind. But I could breathe there. For the first time in years, I could breathe. I thought the restraining orders would give me a buffer. I thought the courts would protect me. I thought, God help me, I could find peace. But Fotis was still watching. Calling. Recording. Manipulating our children. He'd violate the rules subtly, then claim innocence. Say I was imagining things. Say I was alienating him from his kids. He was smarter than most abusers, calculated, patient. He weaponized charm and money, used the legal system as a playground, and twisted every interaction into evidence against me. At night, I couldn't sleep. I'd stare at the ceiling and wonder if he was outside. I started locking every door twice. I left lights on just in case. Sometimes I'd dream of blood on the stairs, and I'd wake up gasping, only to find myself alone in the dark with my heart thudding like a warning. I told people. I documented. I begged for someone to believe me. But the world doesn't always listen to women like me until it's too late. And then came the day that would mark the end of everything I knew. May 24th, 2019. A Friday. I woke up early. Made breakfast for the kids. Packed their lunches with little handwritten notes, smiley faces and I love you as scrawled in Sharpie. I kissed their foreheads, ran my fingers through their hair, and made sure none of them saw how tightly I was holding it together. I dropped them off at school. That drive, it felt ordinary. The sun was bright, the air warm. I remember thinking, maybe today will be boring. God, I could use boring. But when I got home, something shifted. I pulled into the garage. The door closed behind me. And then, I don't know how to explain it, I felt watched. Not just seen. Hunted. Like prey. My keys were still in the ignition, my phone buzzing with reminders, emails, errands, life pulling me in a dozen directions. But I froze. There are moments you don't realize are final until they're replayed on the news. They found my blood. On the floor. On the door. On the kitchen sink. There were zip ties in the trash. Sponges. Bleach. The car, my car, was gone for hours before it was returned. The passenger seat adjusted. The carpet torn. My purse missing. And then there were the surveillance tapes. Him, Fotis, caught dumping garbage bags into bins across Hartford. Bag after bag. He wore gloves. The girlfriend was with him, too. They moved fast, like people on a schedule. Like people with a plan. He said he was innocent. He said it with the same voice he used to say he loved me. And months later, before he could stand trial, he swallowed a fatal dose of truth. He died with a note in his pocket claiming he didn't do it. But if he didn't, why did they find my blood? Why were there bags of my belongings in public dumpsters? Why did he erase the security footage? Why did he take me away from my children? Why? I ask myself that question every night. In this place. In this silence. In this dark that only I can see. My name is Jennifer Dullows. And this is the truth they tried to bury. But I'm not done speaking. Not yet. Chapter 2, Red Flags and Rearview Mirrors. The thing about red flags is they don't wave like banners. They whisper. They flicker at the edge of your vision. They blend into the wallpaper of daily life. Until one day, you look back, and the whole damn house is draped in them. When I first met Fotis, it felt like I was being chosen. Not just loved, but selected. He had this presence, this magnetic pull that made everyone lean in. He didn't flirt like most men. He made you feel like the center of gravity had shifted, and you were suddenly orbiting him. He knew how to speak in compliments that sounded like promises. How to touch your wrist just long enough to linger in your bloodstream. He was successful, charismatic, foreign Greek, which he wore like a badge of cultured mystique. And me, I was the Ivy League introvert, the bookish daughter of privilege, someone who had always played it safe. I thought I was falling into something extraordinary. I didn't realize I was being studied. Fotis didn't fall in love. He acquired people. It started innocently enough, little corrections about how I spoke in public. "You talk too fast," he'd say, laughing. "Try to sound more composed, you'll be taken more seriously." He'd suggest I wear my hair down, because it made me look more approachable. Then it became suggestions about my friends, my colleagues, my hobbies. Before I knew it, I was making excuses to skip dinner with friends. I was editing myself in real time to avoid triggering his moods. I stopped writing. I stopped singing around the house. I stopped telling anyone the full truth. I was becoming the version of me that he approved of, and erasing the one I'd built for myself. There were fights, sure. All couples argue. That's what I told myself, especially in those early years. But our fights didn't end with resolution. They ended with silence, or with me apologizing for things I wasn't even sure I'd done. He was an expert in making me feel crazy. He had this way of turning every argument inside out. If I brought up something that upset me, he'd pivot so fast that by the end of it, I was the one defending myself. I'd catch him in lies, about money, about meetings, about women, and he'd swear I was paranoid. "You're imagining things, Jennifer. You need help." And sometimes I believed him. That's the part that still burns. The fact that I knew something was wrong deep in my gut, and still I doubted myself because he was that good, that precise in his manipulation. He didn't scream. He didn't hit. He eroded. He made me feel invisible without ever raising his voice. It wasn't until I started keeping a journal that I saw the pattern. Entry after entry, month after month, I started to see the repetition. The gaslighting. The sudden warmth after cruelty. The gifts. The guilt trips. The control disguised as love. It was like watching a horror movie in slow motion, except I was the one locked inside the screen, screaming behind soundproof glass. After our fifth child was born, something in me began to shift. Not quickly, not dramatically, but a quiet voice, one that had gone quiet over the years, began to whisper again, "This isn't right." I'd sit in the nursery with our newborn, watching his tiny chest rise and fall, and wonder what kind of example I was setting for our children. What kind of future they'd have if they learned this version of love? If they thought this tension, this unspoken terror, was normal? I reached out to my family, to close friends. I started speaking honestly again. Not much, but enough to put cracks in the story I'd been telling myself. I went back to therapy. I took notes. I documented everything. Because by then I knew, I couldn't just walk away. Fotis wasn't the type to let go. He was the kind of man who saw rejection as disrespect, who viewed loss as betrayal. The day I filed for divorce, it felt like I was lighting a match in a forest of gasoline. I was terrified, but I also felt alive. He didn't react the way I expected, at least not at first. He played it cool, like it didn't rattle him, like he had the upper hand, but underneath that calm veneer, I could see it rage. Cold, festering rage that lived behind his eyes like a second skin. He didn't want reconciliation. He wanted war. He hired one of the most aggressive custody lawyers in the state, filed motion after motion, tried to paint me as unstable, as unfit. He claimed I was manipulating the kids, turning them against him. He said I was trying to ruin him, but he didn't know I had receipts, emails, voicemails, photos, texts, bank statements. I documented everything, every deviation from court orders, every inappropriate interaction, every violation of boundaries. Because I knew he was dangerous. What scared me most wasn't the overt threats. It was how methodical he was, how he played the long game, how he smiled in court and lied without blinking, how he'd charm school officials, therapists, even judges. He was strategic in every move, and I was exhausted. I started looking over my shoulder in parking lots, checking the backseat of my car before I got in. I changed my routines, stopped posting on social media. I told my friends, if anything ever happens to me, look at him first. Because I felt it coming. Not a specific day. Not a specific plan. Just a rising tension. Like thunder before a storm. He began seeing a woman, Michelle. I'll say her name because she deserves to be remembered for her choices, too. She was in our house. Around our children. Helping him plot and plan and smile for the cameras. I tried to alert the courts. I tried to get someone, anyone, to take the threat seriously. But unless there's a black eye or a bullet hole, people don't want to call it abuse. They want evidence. They want bruises they can photograph, statements they can file. Not fear. Not instinct. Not bloodstains on the soul. And then, just when I thought it couldn't get worse, he stopped trying to win. He started trying to destroy. He hacked into my emails. Hired private investigators. Filed legal complaints so exhausting I could barely breathe. He wanted to break me. And some nights, I thought he would. But then I'd walk into my kids' bedrooms, watch them sleep, listen to the soft rhythm of their breathing, and I'd remind myself they deserve better. They deserve to know their mother fought like hell for them, even if it killed me. I don't know when exactly I became afraid of dying. Maybe it was when I caught him staring at me a little too long across the courtroom. Maybe it was when I found the car parked too close outside my house, engine running. Or maybe it was when I stopped seeing the man I married and started seeing something else, something hollow, reptilian, dangerous. And still, I kept going. I woke up every morning and made breakfast, packed lunches, smiled through the tension, documented, survived, because I believed I had time, because I didn't think he'd actually do it, because I didn't realize until it was too late that he already had a plan. And the day that plan went into motion was the last time I saw my children. Chapter 3, May 24th, 2019, my last day. I've replayed that day 1,000 times in my head. It loops like a haunting lullaby, familiar, warm, but stitched with something terrifying underneath the melody. I've memorized the hours, the sunlight, the sounds of my children laughing that morning. Their sleepy eyes, the way my youngest clung to me before letting go. The drive to school. The goodbye kisses. The lies I told myself about what would come next. It was just another Friday. But I felt it. In my gut. That shift in the air. That static on my skin. That something wicked sense you can't explain, but your body knows. Something was coming. I woke up around 5:40 a.m. Earlier than usual. I hadn't slept much the night before. Tossed and turned with dreams I couldn't remember, just impressions, shadows, whispers, a door that wouldn't stay shut. I took a long shower. Let the water run until it turned cold. I remember watching the steam fade from the mirror and thinking, this is the last time I'll see myself clearly. That morning, the house felt oddly still. The kids were still asleep, their rooms cloaked in soft blue light. I made breakfast like I always did, eggs, toast, a smoothie. Packed their lunches. Slipped handwritten notes into their bags. A little heart. A little encouragement. You've got this. I'm proud of you. Love you more than the sky. I always tried to give them light, even when I felt like I was drowning in darkness. At 7:20, they began shuffling into the kitchen, rubbing their eyes, voices groggy but sweet. The youngest climbed into my lap. The others joked about tests, asked about weekend plans. Just life. Beautiful, messy, ordinary life. And all I could think about was how much I loved them. We left around 8 o'clock. I drove them to school like I always did. The same roads. The same radio station. The same small talk. I kept glancing at them in the rearview mirror, drinking in their faces like I was afraid they'd disappear. And I swear, I almost turned the car around. Almost. But I didn't. I smiled. I waved. I told them, "I'll see you after." And they believed me. Because I meant it. They got out. Doors closed. Backpacks bouncing. No tears. No drama. Just trust. And then they were gone. And I was alone. I drove back to the house on Wells Lane. A quiet street tucked between trees and privilege. The kind of place where neighbors wave and security systems blink, and everything looks safe from the outside. But inside, the garage door opened like a mouth waiting to swallow me. I remember the creak of it, the way it rolled up too slowly. I pulled in, engine humming, and sat there for a second, hands still on the gear shift. Something about the silence felt off. Not just empty, but wrong. Like someone had pressed pause on the world. I should have left. I should have reversed. But I didn't. I turned off the ignition. Reached for my bag. My phone buzzed, reminders, meetings, errands. I had plans. I had a list. There was a doctor's appointment. Court paperwork. Groceries. Instead, I opened the door. And stepped into hell. I don't remember the blow. Not clearly. Just a flash. A moment. Then confusion. Pain. Then blood. The world tilted. My vision went fuzzy at the edges. My mouth opened to scream, but no sound came. Hands grabbed me. Rough. Familiar. Not panicked, but focused. Planned. I felt something tighten around my wrists. A zip tie. The cold burn of plastic biting skin. My body twisted, survival instincts firing. But he was stronger. He always had been. A knee in my back. A rag in my mouth. Weight pinning me down. I couldn't breathe. And then I saw his face. Fotis. My husband. My killer. His eyes weren't full of hate. They were empty. Just blank. Like this was a chore. Like this was something he had to do. "You should have stayed quiet," he whispered. "That was it. Not I'm sorry. Not forgive me. Just that. You should have stayed quiet." I remember fading in and out. My body numb. The smell of bleach. The sound of a hose running. The floor soaked in red. My red. I saw my own blood pooling like oil beneath a car. I watched as he mopped. As he scrubbed. As he erased. He didn't panic. He was prepared. Every movement was practiced. Gloves. Sponges. Trash bags. Like he'd done it before. Or rehearsed it. He changed clothes. Bagged mine. I saw him dragging something, a duffel. A bin. My stomach twisted, and I realized, it was me. Or what was left of me. I don't remember anything after that. Not the drive. Not the dumpsters. Not how many pieces I was in when he tossed me away like trash. But I remember this. I never got to say goodbye. The investigation started that afternoon. I missed appointments. Calls went unanswered. My nanny showed up to find the house locked, and me missing. My friends began to worry. Then my mom. Then the police. They searched the house. Found blood. Found signs of struggle. Found him, on camera, driving a red truck, dumping garbage bags in 30 different spots around Hartford like he was dropping off goddamn donations. And then came the evidence. My blood on the garage floor. Blood on the door. Zip ties. Gloves. A bra. Surveillance footage. Phone pings. Gas station receipts. And his alibi? Weak. Disjointed. Full of holes. And yet, he swore he was innocent. He smiled at reporters. He stood in court with a smug look like the devil had taught him how to grin. He said I ran away. Said I was unstable. That I did this to myself. "No, Fotis. You did this. You hunted me. Planned it. Executed it. And then tried to erase me. But you forgot something. I existed. And there are people who remember." He never stood trial. He was out on bail when the weight of his lies finally cracked him open. He wrote a note. A pathetic, spineless attempt at vindication. He took a fatal dose of medication. Alone. Just like he left me. But I'm still here. In every fingerprint. Every scrap of blood. Every journal entry I wrote warning that he would hurt me. Every time my kids look up at the sky and ask why. I'm there. I am the evidence. Chapter 4, Echoes in the Silence. After I vanished, the world didn't stop. That's the cruel part. You imagine that when you disappear, the sky might crack open. That people will feel it. That clocks will pause mid-tick. That the earth will sigh in grief. But the sun kept rising. Traffic lights changed. Coffee shops opened. And life, without me, just kept going. My name was on the news that night. Local at first. Then national. Photos of me smiling, holding my kids, walking through life in the before. News anchors with concerned brows and voices polished for tragedy. A mother of five. A bitter custody battle. A missing woman. They speculated. They spun theories. They said my name over and over, but none of them knew who I really was. They didn't know I once read bedtime stories with silly voices. That I used to journal every night by candlelight. That I loved rainy mornings and clean sheets, and the way my daughter's nose scrunched when she laughed too hard. I became a headline. A hashtag. Hashtag justice for Jennifer. But I was also just gone. The detectives knew right away. They saw the scene. Blood in the garage, droplets leading toward the car, a half-clean trail of evidence. And they didn't need a psychic to connect the dots. I wasn't missing. I was murdered. But without a body, the law hesitates. They searched everywhere, landfills, lakes, storage units, wooded trails. Dogs were brought in. Forensics swarmed the house. Drones hovered over rivers and ponds and backroads. Volunteers combed through forests with sticks and flashlights, whispering my name like a prayer. But I was nowhere. Because Fotis made sure of that. Michelle Tracones, his girlfriend, wasn't just a bystander. She was the second pair of gloves. The second set of lies. She helped him clean. Helped him hide. Helped him dump pieces of me across the state, as if I were something disposable. Surveillance footage showed them together. Multiple stops. Multiple bags. They even took a trip to a car wash, vacuuming out the back seat like evil could be wiped away with quarters and soap. Michelle didn't cry for me. She didn't call the police. She didn't tell the truth. Not until the walls started to close in. When the charges came, evidence tampering hindering prosecution, her mask began to slip. She lawyered up, claimed she didn't know, said she was scared, said she trusted him. But I saw her. In the videos. In the timelines. In the mirror of this nightmare. She wasn't scared. She was complicit. The hardest part? My children. They waited for me that day. Backpacks hung by the door. Shoes lined up. Dinner uneaten. Five souls orbiting a mother who was never coming home. I think about them every second. I remember their routines. Their scents. The way they curled into my arms like they belonged there, which they did. Which they still do. They were told I left. Then that I was missing. Then silence. What do you say to a child when their mother is erased? What do you say when justice is delayed? When the system protects the accused more than the silenced? For months, Fotis walked free. Bail posted. PR statements. Courtroom appearances in suits that cost more than my entire closet. Cameras flashing. Microphones shoved in his face. And every time he said, "I didn't do it," he looked the world in the eye and lied. Over and over. But behind the scenes, he was slipping. The pressure was mounting. The evidence tightening. Detectives were following the data. Phone pings, vehicle trackers, deleted files, timelines that didn't add up. They traced his movements. Matched blood evidence to me. Found my DNA in the car. Found my clothes in the trash. The net was closing. And Fotis knew it. He began acting erratic. Defiant. Suicidal, though he'd never admit it. He refused to testify. Refused to apologize. Refused to face what he did. And then in January 2020, the story shifted. He was due in court that morning. But he never showed up. Instead, he parked in his garage, sealed the door, turned on the engine, and closed his eyes. Coward. He didn't leave a confession. He didn't name accomplices. He didn't draw a map to my remains. He wrote a short note denying guilt, blaming the world for misunderstanding him, and took the easy exit. And I stayed missing. My family grieved without a grave. My children held photos instead of hands. My name became legislation, Jennifer's Law, a symbol of what happens when women cry for help and aren't heard. It wasn't just about me anymore. It was about every woman who documented abuse, who filed restraining orders, who tried to escape, only to be met with bureaucracy and shrugs. It was about the silence that follows a scream no one wants to acknowledge. I became an echo. And yet, I am still here. In the courts. In the bills passed. In the conversations that no longer allow custody to silence abuse. In every survivor who speaks up and says, "I'm not going to wait for it to get worse." Michelle eventually pleaded guilty. Not to murder. Not to conspiracy. but to cleaning up the mess, to tampering with evidence, to lying to the police, to helping a man cover up the slaughter of his children's mother. She got a deal. She walked out of that courtroom into a world that still spins. And me, I'm somewhere in the silence, maybe scattered in a landfill, maybe buried in a forest, maybe nowhere anyone will ever find me. But my voice didn't vanish. You're hearing it now. You're carrying it with you. And that means he didn't win. Chapter 5, The Voice You Tried to Bury. You thought you could silence me. You thought that by spilling my blood, scrubbing the floor, vacuuming the car, and tossing me into bins like garbage, you'd erase me. You thought that without a body, there would be no justice. No proof. No memory. No voice. But here I am, still speaking, louder than ever. You didn't kill my voice, Fotis. You amplified it. You gave it teeth. I think about my children every day. Every hour. Every breath I didn't get to take. Every milestone I didn't get to witness. I wasn't there when they cried into their pillows the night I didn't come home. I wasn't there when they asked why Daddy looked calm while Mommy was still missing. I wasn't there for their birthdays, for bedtime stories, for morning pancakes or prom photos or scraped knees. But I left behind pieces of myself for them. Little breadcrumbs of love. The notes in their lunchboxes. The stories I whispered into their dreams. The lullabies I sang on nights when the storm outside felt too close to the one inside our home. And most of all, I left them the truth. I told people. I documented. I screamed without raising my voice. And when they dig through the past now, when they read my journals, my emails, my pleas, what they'll find is not just a case file. They'll find me, a mother who fought. Even in silence, I made noise. To the courts who failed to see the danger. I hope you're watching now. You looked at documents and ignored the tone behind them. You saw accusations and forgot to look for patterns. You gave him chance after chance, as if abusers deserve more rope instead of tighter restrictions. My blood stains more than the garage floor. It stains a broken system that asked for proof of pain instead of listening to the people in it. It stains silence. It stains inaction. And now, because of me, that silence has cracks. They passed Jennifer's law in my name. It wasn't enough to save me. But maybe, just maybe, it'll save someone else. Maybe the next woman who says, "I'm afraid he'll kill me," won't have to say it twice. Maybe the next judge will look past the charm and money and polished alibis to see the pattern. To see the red flags. To believe her. That's what this story became. Not a tragedy. A warning. An alarm that won't shut off. Michelle eventually stood in court and admitted what she did. Not the full truth. Cowards never tell at all. But enough. Enough for the world to see that she was part of the machine that crushed me. She said she was sorry. She said she made bad choices. But her apology came years too late. I wonder if she dreams of bleach. If the image of my blood haunts her. If she hears my name in her sleep. Because the truth is, I never left. I am in the courtroom. In the tape recordings. In the eyes of my children. In the memory of everyone who watched the news and said, "Something isn't right here." To Fotis, this part is for you. You didn't win. You didn't get to rewrite the story. You may have buried my body, but you didn't bury me. Your legacy is not luxury real estate or international charm. It's cowardice. It's the image of a man dumping bags into the dark while pretending to be a father. It's the pathetic note you left behind when the truth got too heavy to carry. You didn't break me. You revealed yourself. And the world will remember you for what you truly were. To survivors listening to this, I know you're tired. I know you doubt yourself. I know you're carrying fear like a second skin, checking doors twice, glancing over your shoulder, whispering truth in places you hope he'll never hear. But please, don't stop speaking. Write everything down. Tell someone. Protect your light. Because there will be people, like him, who will try to convince you that you're crazy. That you're imagining it. That you're the problem. You're not. You're the fucking warning siren. You're the voice that will help someone else survive. And if my story helps even one woman get out, then I haven't truly disappeared. To my kids, I'm sorry. I'm sorry I wasn't there that day. I'm sorry I didn't turn the car around. I'm sorry that you had to carry questions too big for your hearts. But please know, none of this was your fault. I loved you with every cell in my body. And even in my final moments, I wasn't thinking of pain. I was thinking of you. I hope you grow up knowing that love is not control. That family should feel like safety, not survival. That your mother was strong, not broken. And that when you hear my story, you don't just hear how I died. You hear how I lived. How I fought. How I told the truth even when no one wanted to hear it. And to the rest of the world, When you think of me, don't picture a missing person on a flyer. Don't picture the footage of dumpsters, the courtroom sketches, the redacted transcripts. Picture a woman holding her child. A woman sipping coffee while writing her heart into the pages of a notebook. A woman who looked fear in the face every day, and still got out of bed. I was real. I was here. I still am. This is my voice. The one you tried to bury. But I'm still speaking. And now, you're listening.